That's the Sonata No. 3 in F sharp minor, Opus 23, by Alexander Scriabin, composed 1897 to 1898, with pianist Matthew Bengston, who has recorded all 10 of Scriabin's piano sonatas, and he's here with me on the phone. Let's see. Hello? Are you there?
Hello, sir.
Hi. Thank you so much, Matt, for staying up. You're in Pennsylvania, is that right?
Yes, I'm outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Delighted to be here.
Great. Wonderful. Well, let's talk about this Scriabin project and what drew you to his music and immersing yourself in these sonatas for what must have been many years.
Sure. Well, this all began when I was a high school student. I was studying at a boarding school, and, you know, I had a pretty full academic load, and I was somewhat interested in composition, and I did some piano playing, but I was not, you know, I was not the sort of person who did the conservatory route from a young age. And I was a fan of Horowitz, as were many young pianists, especially at that time. And Horowitz passed away when I was in high school, and when his obituary came out, there was a discography connected to it, and I always enjoyed exploring repertoire. And the one recording on there in the New York Times that caught my attention was this Scriabin recording, because he always liked to play these two very popular etudes, Opus 2, No. 1, C sharp minor, and the Opus 8, No. 12, in D sharp minor. Just wonderful, you know, emotionally moving, affecting, powerful pieces. Those were the only two pieces that I knew. So I picked up this recording, and I was completely blown away by this music. It was such rich, romantic, expressive music with lots of originality. There was a wide range of style. So I just really got interested right away. I started practicing some of these pieces, which I have to say are some of the first music that really made me practice very seriously because it was so demanding.
Mm.
But I started collecting other recordings of these sonatas, and I thought, wow, there's 10 sonatas here. There's not a single weak one in the lot. It's, you know, since the time when the piano sonatas were big with Mozart and Beethoven and Haydn and so forth, you know, what better group of piano sonatas are there? So I just started tackling them. I certainly didn't have the idea that I'd end up recording them all, but I just took them on one at a time, and I enjoyed it, and I had good responses, and so here I am.
Yeah, it can be an unsettling and even disturbing world to live in, the world of late Scriabin especially.
Sure.
Was that difficult to just, you know, spend hours and hours a day with that music?
It can be. And I have to say that, of course, this being the anniversary year and with my recording and many all Scriabin concerts, I'm completely immersed in this music right now. I'm also involved in a book project on it. And it's a wonderful thing, I think, to be immersed in for a time. But after being immersed in it for a while, it is very intense. It's extremely powerful stuff. I enjoy playing Mozart and Bach and some harpsichord, and just to do something that's completely the opposite, which is very refreshing.
Mm.
I think it can get to be a lot. I think if you tried to listen to all the 10 sonatas in one sitting, if you're not used to it, it might be a little bit off-putting, but I think it's just really fantastic music, and the more time you spend with it, especially in the beginning, I think the more you realize, you know, Scriabin has a little bit of a reputation for being kind of insane and irrational, but he's a very, very solid compositional architect.
Mm-hmm. And what's amazing also is that he lived such a short life. 45, 44, he died?
Yeah, 44
at the age
years.
What was the age?
44 years.
44
right?
Years.
71 or two until
right.
1915.
But yet we, I mean, that's even the age when some composers are really coming into their own. But we talk about early, middle, and late Scriabin, and he had definite sort of stylistic, a stylistic range within
sure.
that short period of time. It's kind of remarkable, I think.
It is. I think it's just astounding. It's popular to divide composers into three style periods, and with Scriabin, also with Szymanowski, another composer of similar time that I'm interested in, it really makes quite a lot of sense, this threefold division. And what we would consider late Scriabin really is a period of only about 5 years, and they are... I mean, I think early Scriabin is absolutely wonderful, and it's very effective, and it, you know, deserves to be played a lot. But I think the late pieces are so original and so influential in many ways that they are really the material that his reputation hinges on primarily.
The very last preludes are really avant-garde. I mean, they're just they're way out there. They're sort of, I don't know, I think so strange.
For sure. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
One thing I enjoy doing with these concerts I'm playing, I enjoy starting the concert with Opus 2, number 1, the C sharp minor. Sorry, I have a bit of a cold. I can't sing so well, but I'm sure most of the audience will recognize this great melody.
That Horowitz made famous, too. Yeah.
Sure. And comes out of, you know, the Russian romantic mold and Chopin and Schumann and Liszt and all the this background, but also having these Opus 74 preludes on the same concert, it's just hard to believe it could have been the same person that came up with these two such different styles of music.
Yeah. In your notes, your notes to these albums, you talk about the three exceptional interpretive achievements of recordings that you've listened to. Can you tell us about them?
Right. Well, the ones I listed were, one of them is Scriabin himself. We have piano rolls of Scriabin. Unfortunately, the technology was rather primitive at that time, and the sound quality, unfortunately, which is the thing he was the most noted for, is not at all reliable. However, his rhythmic drive, and especially the performance of that D-sharp minor etude, is quite incredible. There's something in, I think, the pedagogy of piano these days that it's generally considered okay to take time to savor beautiful moments, but if you rush ahead, it's sort of considered to be a fault, and it's usually something to be corrected. And often that is indeed the case, but if it's used effectively, it can really make this music very exciting, and Scriabin does it a lot, not just in that one etude, but even in, for instance, the poem Opus 32, number 1, that's on my second album, and a number of other pieces of Prelude Opus 22, number 1, I've been playing a lot this year in G-sharp minor. He does quite a big acceleration, and it makes a tremendous effect. So that's one aspect that I would consider to be germane to, you know, stylistic Scriabin performances, that sense of rhythmic excitement. Another that I mentioned is Vladimir Sofronitsky, who married Scriabin's daughter and was a great pianist in lots of repertoires, but he was especially known as a great Scriabin player. Now, he had this manic side also, but contrasting with that, he has this very floating, weightless sonority with just absolutely no sense of, you know, this idea of a piano hitting, hammers hitting strings. This sense of percussion is just completely weightless, suspended sonority, which is something that Scriabin was known to have taught his pupils, that even the fortissimo should sound soft. It should never be attacked. And Sofronitsky was a master of that. And the third thing that I referenced was, of course, Horowitz, whom I mentioned as the first influence for me. And Horowitz's greatest achievement as a pianist is generally considered to be his mastery of tone colors, which are extremely important for Scriabin's imaginative world. And Horowitz just had such a wide range, and I think they were rarely more effective than they were in his Scriabin performances.
Yeah. So those are your three major influences when you were preparing these your own interpretations.
Those are ones that I mentioned, although there is another one that I've listened to a number of times that I wish I had referenced in the notes, because he's such a fantastic pianist and composer, also was very influenced by Scriabin, is Feinberg.
Oh, yeah.
Feinberg is an extremely, it's just a fantastically imaginative Scriabin player. He played the fourth sonata for the composer, and who said that, you know, this was really the most convincing interpretation he'd ever heard, and he was certainly not known for giving compliments. There's a recording of his Mazurka's Opus 3, is very, very early, and what we would consider the Chopin-esque Scriabin, that are just remarkably imaginative renditions that are, you know, I think would capture the better aspects of early 20th century pianism. Mm.
And what about Richter playing Scriabin?
Yes, Richter, absolutely. Richter has this sense of uncanny concentration and just expressive power, being able to sustain tension over long periods, even often in slow tempos especially. And I think there's one recording of Richter especially, is the sixth sonata, which is a very demonic and dark piece, but I found it to be quite difficult to play in public. It's very repetitive. Every time these menacing bells come back, there's a slightly different angle to it. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of piece that really reveals the difficulties. If there's somebody who's not what I would consider to be a natural Scriabin player, I think that the sixth sonata would give them a lot of trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
But Richter has, I think, a uniquely extraordinary rendition of that sixth sonata that's very, of course, Richter had his own personal demons, but that recording really brought out the character of that piece in a very powerful way.
These are two recordings of Scriabin that you have out, and they're recorded on different pianos in different halls with different recording engineers. So that's interesting because they have slightly different sounds, and they're on Romeo Records label. Tell us about that label.
Yes, it's actually pronounced Romeo.
Romeo,
the original Italian of, you know, Romeo and Juliet. So he put the little accent on the E to pronounce him in the original Italian name. His name's Romeo Manarino, and he's an Italian-American. He's based in Staten Island. And it just so happens that this coming Sunday I've got a concert in Staten Island where I'm playing half Bach, well-tempered clavier, and half Scriabin. And Romeo Manarino, he goes by Ron, will actually be there. It's at St. Albans Church in Staten Island, and it's very, very close to where the record label is based. Ron used to work for Qualitine Imports, and he broke off in them and set off his own record label, I think, in a very noble pursuit to help people who've done good work in recordings to get exposure.
Sounds like a great relationship.
He's a fantastic human being.
Tell us about playing Scriabin in the Himalayas this past summer.
Sure. That was certainly a unique experience in my life, or I think any performer's life. The background of this is the famous or infamous conception Scriabin had of what we call the Mysterium, which was this, Gesamtkunstwerk, as we would say with Wagner. It's this complete total work of art. It was supposed to combine music and colored lighting and perfumery and caresses and architecture and so forth. This idea of synesthesia that was common in the among the symbolists in Russia and France at this time, that he believed would unite the entire human race and bring everybody to a higher level of consciousness, essentially. But he envisioned this event was going to take place in the Indian Himalayas. And so this British group, XYZ, it's called, it's basically a film crew, a film and photography outfit, did some research in the area and realized that nobody had ever performed a Scriabin concert in the Himalayan mountains. And now that I've been there, I think I can see why. It's a logistical nightmare. It really was a fantastic thing for them to actually bring this off, especially in the relatively short time that they had to plan it. But the event was held at Thiksay Gompa Buddhist Monastery in near Ladakh, India, and it was on the summer solstice, and there were two concerts. I gave a solo recital, about an hour and a half of full range of Scriabin's music, and there was also a recital for two pianos and a tenor, where they did transcriptions of his symphonies and some vocalises on some of the more popular ages. Excuse me. So the two concerts were combined with some colored lights and with cham dance, which is a traditional Buddhist dance form from that area. So it was a little bit postmodern, and it was a combination of Scriabin's vision with the contemporary culture in the area. But I thought it was a very touching, touching kind of gesture. And there was also perfume. There's a well-known, regarded French perfume maker, Michel Rudnitska, created four different kinds of perfumes, and they were diffused into the air at different moments, supposedly to match the ideas of the music as Scriabin would have intended.
Huh.
Of course, all this is speculative because it was only going to be included with the music of the Mysterium, which doesn't exist. All we have is 58 pages of sketches for that. But, you know, this event was an homage to Scriabin and what he stood for and some of his ideas, and it took place in the locale that he envisioned. So it was a pretty moving moving event. I should say that any listeners who are interested should go to ScriabinInTheHimalayas.com, and there's a 3-minute video trailer that give you some sense of what we did.
Mm. Great. We're going to listen to your, you mentioned the Black Mass Sonata, but we're going to listen to the White Mass Sonata number 7, Opus 64,
great,
which he wrote 1911, 1912. Anything you want to say about this before we hear it?
Well, the White Mass I made sure to include in that Indian concert because he often said to his amanuensis, Leonid Sabineyev, he says that this music is already approaching the Mysterium. He thought it was a pure and holy piece. It was this idea of dematerialization, that everything was on a much higher spiritual plane. It was not kind of the white hot passion, the romanticism that you hear in the third sonata. So it's interesting counterpart to what the listeners have heard already, and it was his favorite piece. After he wrote it, he performed it constantly.
Great.
Well, so it has a very ritualistic character, which the audience in the Mysterium was supposed to wear white robes. So it's kind of very formal, ritualistic character in this piece.
Well, thank you so much, and congratulations on these great
Thank
recordings.
You very much. Yeah. It was great to be here.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Have a good night.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. It's Matthew Bengston on the phone from his home outside of Philadelphia. We'll hear his recording of the Scriabin Sonata No. 7, Opus 64, called White Mass, 1912.